You're good at art because you work hard at your art. Start With This, a podcast featuring Night Vale creators Joseph Fink and me, Jeffrey Craner. Each episode, we discuss a topic and then give you two assignments, something to consume and something to create. Start With This, writing for performance.
Art is hard. Starting is hard. If you want to start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
Way back in 2005, I went to Chicago to see my friend Jen. She said she wanted to take me to see a show. She wouldn't tell me anything else about it. Just come see the show with me, she said. And we had deep dish pizza, which is technically not pizza, but congealed tomato soup in a bread bowl. And then we went up to Andersonville to see the neo-futurists perform a show called The Infinite Wrench. Although back then it was called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. I was 30 at the time, and I had been writing most of my life and writing plays for at least 10 years. And I'll be honest, I had never seen anything like this show. There was no fourth wall, but it wasn't improv either. It was weighty, serious, sometimes. It was also funny and weird, sometimes. And it all moved so fast. 30 short plays performed in a random order, competing against a countdown clock set for exactly 1 hour. The performers were not actors, or at least not acting parts that weren't really themselves, and they played with the basics of storytelling and audience involvement like a kid in a sandbox, building then destroying, building then destroying, and I had never seen anything like it. And these 60 minutes changed how I thought about theater. Not just as an audience member, but as a writer. I didn't want to write things just because they were good stories or because the language was compelling. I wanted to write words that created immediate action. I wanted to write scenes that acknowledged the presence of an audience. One of the first plays performed that night in 2005 at the Neo-Futurarium in Andersonville, Chicago, was what really shook me as a writer. It was so simple, so ingenious, and it was called For No Apparent Reason, and Despite the Late Hour, the Neo-Futurist and the audience member sat down to an awkward continental breakfast. I'm Jeffrey Craner, and I'm here by myself in my closet that doubles as a recording studio. What follows me is a recording of a live show that we did in Boston the weekend of the Podtails Conference. Joining me and Joseph on stage that night was neo-futurist, writer for the podcast Unwell, and the creator of that brilliant play I just mentioned, Bilal Dardai. All right, let's get started.
Hey everybody, well, welcome to Start With This. This is the show where we try to get you excited and working on your writing or your podcasting or whatever work it is that you are doing, one simple assignment at a time. The topic of discussion for tonight, writing for performance. We did not bring the audio cue for the theme song, so we're just going to try and sing it. If anyone wants to join in with us here, let's do that now.
Art is hard, starting is hard. If you want to start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
In 2005, I went to Chicago to see my friend Jen. She said she wanted to take me to see a show.
That was significantly louder than I thought it was.
See my friend Jen in Chicago, and she wanted to take me to see a show. She would not tell me anything else about this show, just she wanted me to come see this show. And we went out to dinner, we had deep dish pizza, which is technically not pizza, but congealed tomato soup in a bread bowl. And then we went up to Andersonville to see the neo-futurists perform a show called The Infinite Wrench. Although back then in 2005, it was still called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. I was 30 at the time, and I had been writing most of my life and writing plays for at least 10 years, and I'll be honest, I had never seen anything like this show. There was no fourth wall, but it wasn't improv either. It was weighty and serious, sometimes. It was funny and weird, sometimes, and it all moved so fast. There were 30 short plays performed in random order, competing against a clock on the wall set for exactly 1 hour. And the performers were not actors. actors, or at least not acting parts that weren't really themselves, and they played with the basics of storytelling and audience involvement like a kid in a sandbox, building, then destroying, building, then destroying. I really had never seen anything like it, and those 60 minutes changed how I thought about theater, not just as an audience member, but as a writer. I didn't want anymore to write things just because they were good stories or because the language was compelling. I wanted to write words that created immediate action. I wanted to write scenes that acknowledge the presence of an audience. One of the first plays performed that night in 2005 at the Neo Futurarium in Andersonville, Chicago, was what really shook me as a writer. It was called Early in the Show, and it was so simple, so ingenious, and the play was called For no apparent reason, and despite the late hour, the neo-futurist and the audience member sat down to an awkward continental breakfast. I'm Jeffrey Craner, here with Joseph Fink, and here with neo-futurist, also writer for the podcast Unwell, and the creator of that brilliant play, Bilal Dardai.
In the weeks leading up to this, reading this thing, I've been waiting to hear what happened in this play. So I'm really excited to hear about it.
Yeah. So, this play, I would bring out a table and a chair. And so, the quick thing to know about our theater is that it's set up, there's a front row that's just on the stage, essentially. There's no partition between. I would set up a table in front of any audience member in the front row, and on this table would be like a carafe of orange juice, two glasses, two croissants, and like a bowl of fruit. And I would sit down in front of them and I would open a newspaper. And I would just like sit there like that with them for a while. And every so often I would like look down from the newspaper and just say something like, "You're not eating." And just this play would last, it could last anywhere from 2 minutes to 3 minutes, and just it would just be me occasionally looking over the paper and then saying something a little tense. the way it led to me asking the question, "Do you have something you regret that you want to tell me about?" And put the newspaper back up, and then if they said nothing, like, "No." Okay. And it would just end with me kind of like quietly storming off with them not having given me whatever it is that I wanted from them. And the goal of that play was to make them feel awkward without knowing why. And usually that succeeded.
And what about that play was so impactful on you?
I think it was because I realized that writing for the theater, there's two things happening in that play for me that was, one was the way you can interact with an audience that's more than just trying to falsely pump up audience energy, or, and it's not, it makes the audience member uncomfortable, but it's not punching down at them, it's not using the power dynamic to make fun of them for who they are or how they appear or anything along those lines. It is creating a real tension through the falseness of theater. So I thought that really stuck with me. And also just the idea that theater is more than storytelling. It's about demonstrating a power dynamic. It's about demonstrating a relationship. It's about showing that sort of thing. And without really having any dialogue at all, it was a really tense scene because of the meta level of an audience member having to interact with performer, and it uses that power dynamic really well, because there's always a performer is going to be here and the audience member here because one person has the stage, one person knows what's going to happen next. And I thought I just used that masterfully, and I thought, I didn't know you could write theater like this. I thought you had to create dialogue. I thought you had to have somebody arguing with somebody else, and you had to build tension through story, but you don't. You can build tension through just a trope or a visual or a relationship. Without really any words.
I've seen the neo-futurists perform somewhere in the number of hundreds of times, probably close to 300 times. And that is one of the most valuable things I learned watching them is that there are an infinite number of ways to bring an audience into the work. That there is an infinite number of ways to communicate with and interact with an audience. That you can always find a new way to incorporate in it. We've brought that into the stuff we do. That we just always, one of the things we try to do is just how we bring the audience into this in a new way.
So I wanted to, that's a good segue into talking about what we wanted to talk about tonight, which is the idea of, there's such a big difference between writing for the page and writing for the performer's voice, whether you're writing for yourself or writing for an actor, or how you're doing that and how you go about thinking about that. And on the surface, that sounds really simple. Like, of course, if somebody's going to be speaking, I'm going to think about how they speak it. But I think there's so many nuances to that in thinking about how you write for somebody who's going to either be performing this on the stage, reading this as a podcast actor, or however you're performing it or doing live. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, so for you two guys, what's different in your mindset if you were writing for the Neo Futurist, or if you're writing for a Night Vale live show, versus if you're writing a short story that's going to be read? What do you immediately think about? What do you think first?
Well, I think a lot about the performer. If I know them, if I know them well enough, then I do have a sense of their cadences and the things I know that they hit really well, and I will try to write for that voice. If I'm just writing like a play that, you know, that can be performed by anybody, I like to think of it sort of like music, and I say that with the caveat that I don't really know how to write music. I don't have that musical talent, but this is like the translation of that for me, of how the words are put together in a way that sounds like it'll have like a certain like wave to it or a certain meter to it. And I think like when you're writing like a short story that's just to be read, you see control to the reader. The reader will read it as fast or as slow as they want. The performer, through direction, through whatever you put on the page, is going to, you have some control over how it's delivered, which I think is a key part of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing, this idea of, because people read at different speeds, so much of writing for the page is you set the time through the language. You can make something feel slow, even if someone's reading quickly, and you can make something feel fast, even if someone's reading slowly, because you can just, the way you write sets the tone and sets the time, whereas with performance, you're working in the same world that everyone's living in. You're working under the rules of physics, and so you have to kind of work in the room you have. I bet a bunch of you have read the Stephen King book on writing. A number of you, yeah. I disagree with a lot of that book. you know, no knock on Steve, he seems very good at writing, but there is one part that I think actually directly relates to this, which he has this passage about what writing is, and he argues that it's telepathy, because it's just transmitting an image he has from his brain to yours. And I think that is true of work on a page, it's telepathy, it's just moving that image back and forth. But with performance, there is a vessel, there's a person on stage doing a thing, and that fundamentally changes the writing. And so you have to write differently. You can't write the same when you're just trying to transmit directly with someone through the words on the page that you would for a performer standing in front of a crowd or even being recorded to be listened to as a podcast. I think it just fundamentally changes the rules and structure of how you're writing that.
I think about the notion of, and we'll talk about this more through tonight, I think so much about just what the audience energy is going to be versus a live show versus recorded, and just knowing that that's how that communication, we talk a little bit about the rhythm of the language, but there's the negotiation of how am I going to write this so that the performer can negotiate that energy, so they can play with that. And it's, for a live show, you really can leave it so much up to the performer. Because right now I can look out at you and I can sort of make choices of if I need to talk louder, if I need to be more intense, if I should just really, really stop and just look at a person. I can you know, bring the speed up more. For a podcaster, it's a little different. You have to rely a little bit more on the audio editor. I do that a lot in editing stuff where I'm like, I'm going to just add several seconds of silence here just to breathe. that I think, oh, now that I'm listening to this with music, we can add more of that. But I think those elements are important too, that you're also thinking about the pacing for the listener, creating the intimacy that we talk about with podcasters.
Yeah, I think live performance, all those things about how timing changes. And one thing you mentioned earlier about like how the Neo-Futurists like have a performance that has no fourth wall. Like one thing I try to make, I think, a lot of theater people understand is that even when you're doing like your conventional, we only talk to each other on stage play, you don't have a fourth wall. If you ever held for a laugh line, you agree there's no fourth wall. Yeah, because that laughter's not up here. It's not in this world. It's coming from somewhere else. So you do it. As a stage performer, you intentionally know that.
Yeah,
make decisions about that.
That's, I think, at the heart of writing for performance, whether it's live or audio, is the audience is there, whether you like it or not.
You
generally you like it.
Yeah. I would prefer that, yeah.
With life, I mean, it's impossible to ignore that there are people and their energy changes things. But even with audio, I think it's fundamentally impossible to ignore that there is a person listening. And that person listening is, another human being. And so in that sense, there is another person in the room with you. And if you completely ignore them, they will feel it.
Yeah.
They will feel it the same way that you would feel it if you walk up to a group of people and they freeze you out of a conversation. Like, that sense will be there even if they're not there in the room you're recording.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's interesting about it, this is like a really particular thing, but it's something I've run into a few times, is like, there are words you find yourself having to change in a sentence, in part because it's, like, say it's a homophone to another word, and something about the sentence in that way, like, when you can't see the word that's being heard, you have a moment of like, wait, did he just say this other word I thought it was? And there are other words that just, no matter how hard your actor tries, like the phrasing, it's going to fall apart every single time. There's the Good Place podcast, which I listen to like after each episode, they talk about the phrase wasp nostrils. Mark Evan Jackson delivered the phrase wasp nostrils and spent forever trying to deliver the phrase wasp nostrils because it was just impossible to get out the, just in the right to deliver wasp nostrils. Just it's something that they have to work on. And there are plenty of lines like that. You might either say no, you're going to do it, or okay, we'll change it to something a little less wasp nostril-y.
When I write for a performer, if I know they're going to have to say it out loud, I do it out loud myself at least 3 times, sometimes more, partly to see if the human mouth can make those sounds. Because sometimes you reach a thing that looked fine on paper, like on paper there nothing was wrong about it, and then you realize that it's just impossible to say those words together because it's wasp nostril.
Right.
That really is hard.
Yeah.
But also I will do my best to perform it. Like I will act it out because that also changes things. Like as I was saying, trying to say wasp nostril in exactly the right tone and not say it wasp nostril.
Right.
So I will try to perform it just to make sure that it also flows when you're trying to act out. You have to make sure that it's even possible to perform when you're ready.
Well, let's talk about working with actors, working with performers, let's say that, right? Because, with the Neo-Futurists, we're not talking about actors in it. And I think some people in approaching their scripted podcasts, too, like, also think about it, like, we're performing the story here. But working with somebody who's not you reading the text that you wrote, like, obviously we have this about just the way words come out of the actors' mouths and being very careful about pacing and structure and things like that, but also, how much leeway do you personally like to give an actor? Do you like to hand it off and do you like to say, whatever that person does, I bet it'll be fine? Or do you like to be like, do this, but do it really good?
I'm careful with where I micromanage, I guess. I think
picking your battles?
Sort of. I think usually it's going to be, let's hear how it sounds coming out of you first, and because I have a lot of faith in most actors I work with. Like I've been lucky to have a lot of good actors to work on many of the things I've done, and there are definitely times where they will say something a certain way that I'm like, oh, that's so much better than it sounded in my head. And I think when I give a note in advance, it's only because it's only because the line might not seem clear in context. Like, if you think of a line, I don't know, even if you just say, how are you, in the middle of, like, other lines, it's like, normally people say, how are you, in a friendly way, and it's important to say to them, no, this is actually a threat. You know, that's what stage directions should be for, but I've ever got a stage direction, and it's like, yeah, consider this a threat.
I'm gonna, anytime somebody gives me something to perform, I'm gonna start with by asking them, would you like to hear what this sounds like coming out of me? That sounds like a threat.
Yeah.
Stage direction.
We've been in this really unique context where we mostly work with performers we've worked with a bunch. That we have this relationship with. And so you and I with Nightville and me with Alice Isn't Dead gave very little direction at all. Alice Isn't Dead especially was just a case of I would write a script, send it to Jessica, she would record it, send it to John, who would add sample music and send it to me, and at no point was there instructions to between any of us on what we should do. And that was intentional because when I trust somebody, I want them to do something to get to 10. That's when the process is really working well, is when, for me, when a performer does something with the line that I didn't see in it. And maybe it changes the story, and maybe it changes the character a little bit, but I'm okay with that. I'd rather write around those accidents than try to tell them how it should be performed, because then if I'm trying to micromanage how they perform, then I might as well not have brought them in. Might as well just perform it myself.
Or if there's written a novel,
yeah. And working with, we've talked before about the value of working with a collective or an ensemble, regular set of people that you know personally, that you have seen perform, that you've written for before, and the longer you have those connections, the more you can fall back on the thing of, like, you just trust them to make a thing that you know they will do really well, and it can save you so much time and energy of having to manage that. But for me, for this year of Within the Wires, we cast somebody I'd never met before. It was interesting to have my co-writer Janina there, who has much more experience in theater than I do, in directing anyway, and so she went and she directed Mona Greta, the actor for the season of Within the Wires, and it was fascinating watching the way Janina worked with her to just sort of retake certain sections, just to say, in this section I want you to think about this as a threat, or I want you to think about this as a plea for, I need you to love me in the way that I want to be loved. And she would just find those phrases of just think about this and then redo this part. And, rather than hammering home, we would have two or three takes, and that was really nice as an audio editor, to then have several versions that I can pull from to take, and that was a much nicer way than pounding an editor like, no, do it like this.
I think part of what we're talking about here, like our directing styles, and I'm sure that out there are groups where it works well for the director to dictate. Which I'm clearly saying in a very negative way, because that's not my preference at all. But I like when a director takes your words to an actor and encourages discovery, as opposed to telling them how it should be. If they're giving line readings, like, I'm sorry if I'm your director. But if they just give them the opportunity to say it a few times and see if they find the subtext, see if they find the subtext that maybe you didn't know you put there, and just like the discovery part is the exciting thing about working with actors.
Yeah, and I always like the surprise grab bag of what Joseph, you were talking about, of the idea of being able to send it off to somebody and they send something back that you didn't ever give them notes on, because it sometimes my reaction has been to those moments of like, that's not at all what I wanted. With working with Cecil on Night Vale, like there's sometimes he sends back a recording where I'm like, no, that is totally different than what I wanted, and then you listen to the whole thing and you think, oh no, this is an amazing choice that I wouldn't be able to give him. So, in talking about this, I think this applies to, I think there's a lot of podcasters here tonight, and this question applies to you guys really well, which is stage directions. And I know that sounds in reply to working on theater, but in podcasting, I think stage directions in terms of motivation for the actor or what they're intending, but also sound effects, I think, are a big question in stage directions in podcasting. And my question is, like, how do you know when you need that stage direction? How do you know when you, let's start with sound effects, how do you know when you need to put in something in an audio fiction format? When do you need a sound effect to pump something up? Let's start with that in stage directions.
Well, need is an interesting word, because I think you never need it. You know, Welcome to Night Vale very rarely has sound effects, and that's intentional, because I do think that, for the most part, you don't need it. I mean, that isn't to say that it doesn't benefit it, that you can't find your own style that has a lot of sound effects, but I do think that if the language is clear, generally you don't need the sound effect. And if you trust the performer, you don't need the stage direction, but I think you can sometimes want it. You know, in your example, like if you have something that's very counterintuitive, mm-hmm. that's real, both with stage directions and also with sound effects. We've used this in Night Vale, where it's like, here's the sound of a house cat, and then it's a blender. that's a moment that doesn't work without the sound. It's built around the counterintuitiveness of the sound.
Right. I think. I think it also depends on the kind of story you're telling and the kind of. Like the structure of it. I mean, if you're delivering a story where you were talking about where your character has gone and what have you, that's a very different thing than two people are talking at the side of the highway, and you don't always want your audio drama to be like, well, here we are at the side of a highway. Because, yeah, that's a bit, but yeah, so then you use the sound of the cars there. But yeah, it depends on the format.
Yeah, it always feels like the sound effect should not be actually not even in unison with the text itself. It should be complementary to it in some way. Like to double up to say, the sound of a highway. If that sound is not clear that it's by a highway, and then you need the actor or the performer to say, we're here by the side of a highway. I'm like, you may not need that sound effect there. To clarify that. But on the flip side, there is a texture element to that. We talked about today, it was on the Found Audio panel, and sometimes you want to create the texture you want. We put very, very subtly underneath, within the wires, we put the sound of a cassette reel playing. And it's just very subtle, but it always starts loud, and then it fades out underneath the audio for a while. It's almost like coloring in only the blue around the edge of the ocean on your map.
Right. I mean, I know, hopefully not speak out of turn here, because the producers were on here tonight as well, but I know that we do a lot of, like, environmental and atmospheric sound, and I think that is important to the aesthetic for us, that part of what's happening is an attempt to create this world in this way, and to have the audience experience a little bit of what the characters in that location are experiencing. And that's how it works for our show, but it doesn't work for every show.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this comes down to how we want to write performance. Because when I think of something like, well, here we are by the side of the highway, really what you're describing there is just bad writing, right? Like, that's just the bad way of doing that. I think there's always a better way to do that. And even, like, if you want to make it very immersive, if you really want to put them in it, which was kind of the goal a bit more with Alice Isn't Dead, that we were supposed to be a bit more in the character's head, a bit more in the character's moment, there's always ways to do that just in the language, which is not to say you have to do it that way, but I do think that there's a lot of freedom to follow what works for you,
right.
As long as you know what the goal of the performance is. If you know the goal of the performance is, I want this to feel like you're in the moment with the person, you can kind of decide, am I the kind of writer that can try to do that with the language, or am I the kind of writer that wants to build that out with the sound? Like, those are, I think, both valid ways to go with it.
I think similar to what Joseph was saying earlier about in writing for performers or writing for performance, having those moments where you stand up and you just read it out loud. You read it as a performance so that you understand the sound that the text will have. I think the same thing goes for, like, audio texture of what you're doing, and by having the sound effect of seagulls by a beach or something, or having the sound near a highway, or that if you're creating some level of person on the street interview sort of thing. You want the sound quality of the audio. You may want to literally go do that scene with a Tascam outdoors on maybe a mildly windy day. I think the other thing, and this speaks maybe more to live performance, but there is the issue all the time of, like, how is the texture of the voice? This is something I always think about with a neo-futurist, because we don't use microphones.
Right.
We're in pretty small theaters, and this is actually a pretty small room as well. This isn't that much, I mean, it's more cavernous, but it's not really much larger than the neo-futurarium in terms of capacity and what it can hold. And the thing is that, like, but here we have the microphones, and it's always an interesting question of how that is. It has to maybe do with the power dynamic. We have the lights down, and we have microphones, and so there's a more direct passive listening to what we have to say, as opposed to in a live performance like The Infinite Wrench, we don't want that power dynamic as sharp.
Yeah. Or, and, you know, and there are times that we will use microphones, but we acknowledge that that is an extra power dynamic that we have chosen in this moment to amplify the voice for some specific purpose. And there's also the reverse of that. Like, you can do, like, a play in that environment where you are deliberately quieter and you are forcing the audience to lean forward, forcing the audience to, you know, you're fighting the air conditioning or whatever, and that can be purposeful. It's something you have to be aware of. I think one of the things that you learn doing, like, the 1 to 2 minute play is the importance of specificity, which I know you understand very well. But like how like every second counts in that. Like every gesture you choose is going to tell a different story depending on how you choose it in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing. There's all these different textures to think about when you're writing for performance versus the page. And yeah, things like how the voice is heard.
Because you can all still hear me when I do this. I'm exactly as audible. But it doesn't
feel the same as if I do this. They're just fundamentally different feeling. So using things like that just don't exist in non-performance form can really change the things you can do with the person listening or the person watching.
I always think of the microphone as a much more intimate sound, because it's just much more full, it's much more in your ear, and I can talk fairly quietly and still be heard without the moment you raised your voice off mic, the tone of your voice changes entirely. The mood you have towards us is changed. Not that I interpreted you as angry, but it's just a different
way. Well, the shape of your mouth, the shape of your throat have to change.
Yeah. There's also, I think, just the physical act of bringing a mic to your mouth, that you have that moment. And then you speak, and that puts this, like, bracket around what you say next.
I feel like we should have done this with megaphones. I need to drive home the point with all of you. Let's talk a little bit more about performers and working with performers. You talked before about Joseph about working with Jessica and John, who does an act, who does music and editing and mixing, but in some ways is kind of a performer for Alice Isn't Dead. But let's talk a little bit about how working with performers that you know and that you've worked with before, about how you're able to write to their strengths. Like, what do you think about as a strength in a performer that you can write to?
Yeah, the more you know a performer, the easier it is to write to them. And when you think of strengths, you think of things like, you know, they can do accents or they can do impersonations, but also just the way they carry themselves. I was talking today about, I wrote for the second season of Alice, I wrote for the performer, Roberta, who just has this intense natural charisma. And so that's just there. You can kind of be aware of it when you're writing, that charisma will carry some of this language, and so I can write in a simpler way and just know that will be there. With Jessica, I had just seen her. Alice Isn't Dead kind of started because I wrote this monologue for a Night Vale live show. And then I sat in the back of the room and I watched her perform it, and she just brought it to life. And so I knew I could write very emotional things for her and just trust that without direction, she would bring them to life, she would make them feel human. So you can write to that you can write to, this is a very human performer, this is somebody that can create a lot of empathy just through their presence.
A lot of times, like, I feel you can cast, when you have a certain level of acting ability, you're casting less on, is this person a good or worse performer? And it's more just, are they the right presence? Are they do they shape the space around them with their voice and their body in a way that fits this? And that the more you know that, the more you can write to that.
Yeah, and I think, because to piggyback on that, like, depending on who you're casting them against, because there's a mix of voices as well. And if you know, if you need, especially like in audio where you know you can't necessarily, like, you don't see somebody tower over somebody else. So what is the way you communicate somebody who's like 6'5", like tower over somebody who's 5'2", just vocally? Like how, like what is the carriage and the cadence in those voices is. It's not just the one person's voice, you're mixing voices.
I think sometimes I work from the point of view of, I just like this person, and I just kind of want to see what they can do, and then you give them a thing, and then they start rolling with it, and then you think, well, now they've helped inform what this will be. You know, casting somebody like Cecil Baldwin is a very, very easy choice to make because he's got such a beautiful, deep voice. But also, when we started Welcome to Night Vale, we didn't know where the storylines were going to go. We didn't know the character's name even. We didn't know anything that was going to happen. And neither did Cecil. And Cecil just has an amazing voice. And then he performs that pilot episode. And then you get to listen to that over and over and over again as you start writing other things. And you realize, I can now write. He sort of informed me who he is as an actor. And so sometimes just using your intuition to say, there's just some small thing I like about this person, and it might be in their ability to perform. It might be something you've seen on stage or heard in a podcast. Or it might just be like, I just inherently trust this person. Like, I'm gonna just give them a thing and let them do it, and then I'm gonna see what comes out of it. And then I can start writing to sort of a character that they might help create just by creating a voice for that character.
Yeah, it's a two-way conversation there, that if you're trusting a performer and you're getting to know them and you're writing to that, paying attention to what they do and writing in response to that. Not improv, like we just don't really do that, but the way that they perform those words, you paying attention to that, being like, this feels like this character's maybe nicer than I've been writing them, or it feels like this character has this darker element to them that I've been ignoring, that I'm getting from this performance. And part of that, I think, that responsibility of trusting the performer is paying attention to what they do and responding to it.
Actually, when you said that just jogged something loose, that I'm going to go a little bit off outline, which is to say, I think one of the advantages for podcasters who are making a serial fiction podcast, something that is sort of ongoing, something that you're constantly writing toward, that's one of the advantages of having more... being more relaxed, being less uptight about what an actor chooses to do with something, because you have the freedom to just let your universe build however you want to let it build. This isn't so tightly written. You know, if you write shows in like 6-episode chunks that are tightly and sharply written, and this needs to be a very solid story, like obviously get that written and give your notes to your actor, things like that. But if you're writing more long form where you're just allowing the world to sort of build, you have that freedom. You have that flexibility. I want to ask about challenging performers, because this is something, Joseph, you like to do. Think about when we met Hal Loveland, who plays the role of Steve Carlsberg on Night Vale. You realize that like Hal is very good at accents. He does good voice work. He has good character voices that he can do. And you thought, well, I want to see if I can write a part for him that makes him do a voice for every single other character in Night Vale. And so you gave him this part before a live show where he had to like impersonate all 5 Hiram heads, and he had to impersonate Cecil and impersonate Carlos and impersonate just about everybody. And I wanted to talk maybe a little bit about that with Hal, but also like in what ways you have challenged your performers.
Yeah, I have this belief that the most interesting thing to watch on stage is someone just barely be able to do something that is very difficult. When I write to challenge, I write to challenge in a way that it's something I know they're good at. So with Hal, I wanted to challenge him on these impersonations because I knew he was so good at them. Yeah, I think that the goal of challenging a performer is not to embarrass them. It's to make them shine. I think about acrobats. You think about acrobats who, if you've ever seen an acrobat show, there's often a trick where they mess up, and then they try again, and they mess up again, and then they try again. And those are the tricks that really are the most impressive when they finally do it. Because the other tricks look easy. But this is the first time you realized how hard it was. When done right, the audience feels how hard it is. They feel the difficulty, and it makes the success all the more impressive, and it makes the failure all the more forgivable if they can't quite pull it off. The audience is still with them because they understood that was really hard, and they almost did it, and almost doing it was really impressive too.
I think also, this speaks to, we talked earlier about, like, you know, you trusting your actor, pardon, this is your actor trusting you. When you challenge them, that you're not doing something to embarrass them. I think sometimes it, you know, requires that moment of you speaking to the actor frankly and saying, like, I wrote this for you because I think you can do this. Like, I see this thing that you have done here, and I think that you can do it. And sometimes it's as you're describing, like, this is a talent that you they have, and you work towards that. But there are times where, I think about, like, maybe an actor who is constantly doing comedic roles, and there's, like, a moment where you see something in that comedy that says, no, I think you could play the bad guy. Like, I think there's something, like, let's see if we can write to that with you. And it's an experiment. It doesn't always work, but it's that discovery thing, again. It's great to watch them try.
Yeah, it's the neo-futurist idea of the possibility of failure. The possibility of failure makes theater really interesting.
Yeah, I think that it's about the question there becomes about whether or not you are showing your audience just how hard that is. You know, and sometimes in podcasting it's a little tougher because if you hear somebody struggling to perform something well in podcasting, you might not be able to see their body language and see the difficulty, and you think, this person's just very bad. and so that's a little bit tougher note to give. So it's more of a matter of for podcasting. But I do think there are ways in which you can, I think it's just a matter of finding that language to your audience to be able to communicate that this is about the difficulty of getting through something. One of my favorite tools has always been to give somebody something to eat, like to try and talk through eating with your mouth full. I think it's really, really great, and I think that's a very clear challenge in audio only too, that you know what it is that somebody's trying to get through the mouthful of marshmallows or whatever that is. So let's talk a little bit about audience energy and this nebulous topic of, so in let's start with live performance and talking about audience energy, how you feel that, how you write towards that, how you as a performer deal with that. When you are sitting and writing something for say, like a Night Vale live show, or whether or not you're writing for your futures or anything you're doing on stage, what do you think of as a writer of how you're going to use audience energy? Where do you see those things? Is it just in laugh lines, or is it in just in dramatic moments? Where do you see the audience energy on the page?
No, it's not just in laugh lines. You want to think about where they are at all times, you know, hushed and tense. Or hushed and somber is another, like, you know, a silent, tense audience is different than a silent, serious audience is different than a silent, sad audience. There's a different energy. And it's almost impossible to explain until you're on stage a few times and you start to get the feel that you can feel that energy. It's present. And the audience feels it too. They feel it from each other. So when you write for an audience, I do think you just have to be aware of where is the audience's energy likely to be, and how does that interact with what I'm writing.
Yeah, and as Jeffrey described, The Infinite Wrench, that because everything is happening in a random order, and because everything is different, the energy of the piece that came before each one, and the energy of the piece that comes after is part of the performance. Sometimes several like plays that came before. If you had just because of luck of, you know, the draw, like three hysterically funny plays happened right before your very serious monologue about about a family member dying, you learn to accept that people are going to laugh at parts of it. And sometimes it's just because they're still residually, like, dealing with the comedy from before. I think that's also important to remember, that they are still hearing the story you're telling, and they are being affected by it, and sometimes they will, like, laugh, and they will immediately feel terrible for laughing because they hear you, but there's just something that's carried forward, that energy is carried forward, and it happens vice versa, too, that the play that killed every single night comedically happened right after that monologue, and nobody's laughing because they're still in that space. And that's something that you can't necessarily, certainly in that instance, you can't necessarily write for that. But if you are the performer, or you're, you know, where you, whoever the performer is, like, has to be kind of aware. You know, it's that idea of, you know, as an actor living moment to moment, that, like, you know, like, sometimes that joke isn't gonna land, and you still have, you can't stop and say, why didn't that joke land? I'm gonna stop here and wait until that joke lands, so you have to keep going.
One of the things I've learned watching all these great actors that we get to work with Night Vale, and especially like kind of what Cecil does with the live show, it's really fascinating, because if you've heard Welcome to Night Vale, especially if you kind of hear the first, you know, 5 to 10 episodes, and that's all you've heard, as Cecil is still figuring out this character, and it still kind of has this very dry way about it, and then you see him in a live show, and you just see how incredibly different it is. The one thing I've realized about watching Cecil perform is that he's learned, as any good performer does, which is, any good live performer does, which is, they've learned the beats are so important. The beats, the language is important too. You want to get the words right. You don't want to fuck up the words. You don't want to, like, stammer over the words. You don't want to get them wrong entirely. But it's more about finding the beats. It's about finding the structure of a joke is just as important as the joke itself. And that's so key to having a repeatable quality for finding the audience laughter or finding the audience tension. I'm going to get the quote wrong, so I'll just paraphrase, but Steve Martin, in his book, Born Standing Up, talks about one of the reasons he left stand-up comedy was that he said, I found it very easy to be great. I found it very, very hard to be good every single night. And finding moments of greatness was the thing where he was like, I knew how to write a good joke, I knew how to write a good bit, but to get it the same every single night so that every audience got their money's worth is so, so, so hard. And it's one of the things that they teach you in really good theater programs, theater academies and conservatories, is that you learn how to recreate the beats. You learn how to recreate the structure of a joke, the structure of drama, the structure of tension, so that no matter what it is you're saying or where your energy level is, you know how to generate at least that every night.
And that's in the writing, a lot of it. You know, there's the performance, but the writing has to... Like, my approach to writing for performance is, if somebody stood up and read it monotone, with no affect, it should still basically work. That the actor, their role should be to use their talent to add something new to it, to bring it up, to bring it even further up. But my job as a writer is to write a thing where the basic beats and energy of the live performance are enough there that if someone just read it, it would still fundamentally be fine. And to me, that to me is my part of the bargain, is making sure that the words are there so that the actor's job is to make it great. That they don't have to worry so much about making it good because the text is kind of there. The text was constructed with that in mind, making sure the structure to be good was there in the first place.
You and I have that advantage of neither of us are very good actors in the sense of, like, I don't need to say that we were never trained in this. But you and I were both comfortable performing, we're comfortable in front of people, we're comfortable with the thing. But if somebody's like, here, I need you to play I need you to play some, like, 18th century British noble person, I'm like, I don't even know where to begin with that accent or how to make this realistic. But I can certainly read words off the page in a compelling way. But I think you know what compelling performance sounds like. And you know the structure of how somebody who is sermonizing should sound, or how somebody who is waxing poetic should sound, or how somebody who is being a stand-up comic, like rapid-fire joke, should sound.
It's the same reason I often don't put stage directions in because, and don't give direction because
I try as much as possible to make the text itself the stage direction, that I write into the text how I want it performed. I write into the text the beats. And if they interpret those differently, that's okay with me, but I just want to make sure that I've structured the performance into the text. You look very suspicious of all of this.
No, I mean, I think I'm suspicious. I think it's a talent that I have not mastered. I
don't think it's a talent in that it's innate. I think it's just a thing I have taught myself to do. But I think it's a learnable skill.
Yeah, well, and I think that, if you got what you wanted despite not doing that, I think that's why I'm codifying it as a talent. I try not to go nuts with stage directions, but I think I do find myself, putting pepper in them in. I don't personally mind them. Yeah, either in myself or others.
Let's talk one more thing I want to get to before we start getting into assignments and maybe a quick video or two, which is to say,
possibly a card trick.
Possibly, oh yeah, a card trick. start with this, your show about magic. I want to talk a bit, because we've talked about this on the show before, and at Podtails today I was hearing more about this too, which is, what does it mean, what is audience intimacy in podcasting? Like, when you're writing audio only, when you're writing for an audience out there, because even if your character, even if your narrator is talking to another fictional character in their universe, they're still talking to the listenership. You are still, as a writer, communicating directly to the listener. And how do you think about it in that way? How do you control this nebulous audience that you can't see, they can't see you, your stuff is recorded in the past before they ever hear it? How do you navigate that intimacy, that relationship? You're like, oh, fucking no.
That's a big question. It's important that, in most cases, it's one person listening to it, one person, one earbud. And I think that's, I can't really necessarily articulate, the feeling of that, but I think it's important to be aware of that you're not shouting to the rafters, you're not making sure that people in the cheap seats can hear everything and see everything. You're just trying to get the story, however it's being told, into one person's ears. I think that affects a lot of how you put together words, put together casting, and we all try very hard when we cast to be mindful of people who might sound a little alike and how often they might find themselves in the same space talking to each other. And once you're aware of that, if you want both those actors, it's like, well, I think individually they're perfect for these. I just understand that they are going to sound a little bit alike. And if I want them in space together, how am I navigating that?
Yeah, it's a very different feeling than, a live audience is bigger in, not necessarily, the live audience where a podcast could be in the millions, depending on the thing, but it's a bigger feeling, it's a bigger energy than the person in their ears. And so I think you have to write, it's like the difference between stage acting and acting for television, this idea that stage acting, whatever gestures or facial expressions, they have to read to the back of the room. And that's the same thing with writing for performances. I think the beats of the writing have to read to the back of the room, whereas with a podcast, when you're writing for audio, you can write much smaller gestures, you can write much smaller pauses, you can write smaller images and still have them land really hard because they're in someone's ear. And you're also in someone's life. When you come to a live performance, none of you live here, I think. You came to this place, you sat in these seats, you're in this dark room looking up at a stage. It's an unnatural position. It feels separate from the rest of your life. Whereas when you listen to a podcast, you might be doing the dishes or going for a run or walking the dog or driving them to work. It becomes part of the texture of your life, and so I think being aware of that, being like, this is a person that might actually be a little distracted, that's something to be aware of, is with a live performance, you can trust them to be a little more focused. With a podcast, somebody had something they needed to tell them, so they just took out an earbud for a second and put it back in, and if your entire written thing
was keyed around one word that happened during the time, then, well, so you have to be just, I think, a little more aware of, like, building in repetition, building an explanation, so that a person can follow it and still live their life.
Well, and I mean, I think that's, because that's accurate, and it's also, sometimes it's something you, because I think about, like, episodes of shows I listen to where they are playing with, like, volume mixing, or they're playing with, like, you're only going to hear this person out of one earbud, or you're going to hear the other one out of the other earbud, like, what that effect is. And I treasure experiments like that, and I think you have to be willing to accept that, yes, sometimes the experiment's not going to land because of the context you're talking about.
I've always felt that more than anything in podcasting is we connect to personalities and not to stories. We learn stories. Like, it's not that stories are useless, right? Like, there's so many podcasts I've heard out there, whether it's a fiction show that you're like, the plot twist in this show is so amazing, or even nonfiction shows, you're like, I totally didn't know that John McCain was such an asshole, or whatever. Like, this is, you just get these, like, oh gosh, the doll John McCain episode is...
It's just a lot worse than you thought.
Yes, that's... you have those podcasts all the time where you obviously have learned something new, so it's not that story or plot isn't important that you just throw it out, but I think what keeps a person, when you are able to take out your earbud and answer a question in real life and put your earbud back in and you just pick back up to whatever you're listening to, it's because... In so many ways, it's like just being in a room with friends, and they have a conversation, and sometimes in a room with friends, you're at a party or whatever, and you're having a great time, and everyone's telling jokes, and you get a text message, and you're like, reach down, and you look back up, and you can rejoin the conversation and still feel the energy from your friends. And I think for podcasting, that's what I think about, is the idea that, you know, somebody's allowed to be distracted for a moment and come back to it. I don't want to write vital information, and if I do, I want to make sure that it is done in a way that is repeatable, or that there is an announcement in the energy of the text of the performer that I need you to just hold still. I need you to just hold still for just a second and really, really listen to what I'm about to say. And creating that type of tone can make a person be like, oh, I should really pause this because this is getting intense.
Yeah, I mean, that is the other way of doing it, is if you do have a moment that has to land once, you can kind of flag it for the person so they know, okay. I mean, and that's good for performance and live thing too, of I think an audience likes to know where they are in a story. I think that's why we like structures. That's why we like to know how long a movie is before we get into it. Like, we just like to know where we are in a story. And so, yeah, if in the writing, kind of let them know something important is about to happen. It hasn't happened yet, but it's about to. It kind of prepares them to focus in, that maybe their mind was wandering for a second, and now they're going to really pay attention.
I think coming back, repetition is so important with that in podcasting, too, because unlike a book, I can't be, like, if I get lost for a second in a book, obviously I can flip back a second, like, oh, okay, that was that guy's name, I get it. And in podcasting, I think you do have to remind people of character names, you have to remind them where we're at, and I think reiterate stories, and I think that's okay to do, right? I really do, without it seeming like you're talking down to your audience at all.
Okay, so you're saying repetition is important.
What I'm saying is repetition is vital to what you do.
But is repetition crucial?
Repetition is a big part of what I do. Thank you. Thanks, man. Can we get the video screen going? I'm going to start doing this. You guys riff on podcast intimacy and all of that.
I just riffed for like a minute on the repetition.
You guys...
Hey, Jeffrey Craner again. Let's take a quick break for an ad, hopefully for an ad. There might not be an ad here, and that's okay too. Honestly, let's just enjoy this brief break, no matter what happens during it.
Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously, May 11th, 2021. The first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship, year by year, without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books.
Okay. Before the show, you pointed out the amazingness of shouting over there to a blindfolded person.
Because speaking of like getting used to audience energy, like one of the things that's fascinating about that play is like the people who really wanted Trevor to tackle Vic because they wanted to see that marinara sauce go flying, which did happen, and we had to clean it up right afterwards. It was terrible. Then not recognizing that shouting at Trevor was making it harder for him to actually track the person in the roller skates. Because he's like, he can't hear. It's like, if you really wanted it, you would shut up and let him listen. But you're not doing that. And all of that is a great example of how we deal with audience energy.
So I want to give, let's do our consume and create assignments for people now.
Let's do it.
So if you have, listen, there's no liner notes because this is a live show. And I can't give you this because it's mine. So I only just have the one copy. So if you need to write it down or type it into your phone, if you want to do that, we'll put this episode up eventually. So all of that will be in the liner notes later. But if you want to do things starting tonight, write it down. Feel free to do that thing. So let's do our consume assignment. This is going to be another 2-minute video that I'm going to show you now. So this is a play done for video by a former neo-futurist named Joey Rizzolo. This video is called Noam Saam. The performance of the text is very straightforward. If you were just to hear this, it would sound like a very straightforward monologue, but the text is not straightforward, and you will see in this video that he's performing the text, but also the script that he is reading from is right next to him. And I just want you to pay attention to the juxtaposition of the written text on the screen and the performed text, and how, just think about how that enhances the story that's being told. When you watch this, I want you to think about how this short play works. How this would work if you only had, say, the text to read on a page and Joey not performing it for you. Or, you know, is that better or worse for you personally? What if this, if this only existed as the text? What does that do to your reading experience? So just think about reading the text on the screen versus how Joey is performing it. This is Noam Saam. So I just want you to think that over in your head about the juxtaposition of text and how it is performed, and we're going to do a Q&A in just a couple minutes here, so if you have questions about that or just have some observations, feel free to think through those. Let's get into our create assignment. So that is you, Joseph.
Hi. So if you wanted to video this bit, go for it, or you can just write it down. The create assignment comes in three parts. I want you to consider what happens to a story in the context of how it is being performed. So the first way we're going to consider a story is on the page. I want you to write a 100-word or so story, so pretty short, in third person, about someone walking into a police station and confessing a crime. This could be a comedic scene or a horrifying one. The crime could be a minor offense or major felony. Keep the story simple and write it to be read silently. Now, write that same story again, still only about 100 words, in first person, narrated by the person confessing. This could be done in present tense, so we are listening to the person talk to the police, or in past tense, the person is telling the story of what happened when they confessed. But imagine you're writing the story for audio only. Think of that voice in someone's ears, the intimacy of that connection. Think about how that affects the comedy or horror or drama of the scene. Does the character address the listener, or is the connection between them and the listener only implied? Maybe include one sound cue. The final time you're going to write it for live performance, again in first person, and again about 100 words, but thinking about it as something done by a performer live in front of an audience, think about the audience's energy during that story, when they hear what the crime was, what the person did, how that affects the comedy, or the drama, or the tension, or the horror. What should the performer be doing with their body? What do you want to tell them specifically to do, and what do you want to leave up to the performer's interpretation? Do they involve the audience at all? And if they do, do they do it directly? Maybe singling out
person in the crowd, or giving the audience a task, or do they do it indirectly, just acknowledging that they're there? But the point is to keep the same beats of the story, and just look at what writing for different audiences does to the texture of what you're writing.
Awesome. So you guys, we wish you the best of luck in creating those things, and make sure you go to our member forum and put up what you've done and give some feedback on what other people are working on as well. So, we have a microphone. Meg over there has a microphone. Meg has a microphone. So we wanted to just, while we have you here, then you can ask some live questions if you have live questions. And we wanted to focus on just the topic of writing for performance in and around that topic, as opposed to maybe like what we thought of Breaking Bad or like, that sort of thing. Or you remember that one time with the Neo-Futurist when you did this thing. Oh, no, actually, that applies. Let's see.
Yeah, we already got a question there. Yeah, just raise your hand.
Oh my god.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So this is sort of a general question. I hope that's okay. So between term papers and just perceiving myself to have done a bad job, I sort of have Lovian response now, where anytime I sit down to write in any context, I just automatically panic. Do y'all have any thoughts on how I can stop?
Yes. Yeah, I've thought a lot about the whole idea of writer's block or writer's anxiety or writer's anything. And I think generally with those things, what you can do is just take out the word writers, because what you're dealing with is block and anxiety. Any problem that's stopping you from writing is just a problem in your life, and it can be thought about in that way. It doesn't have to be taken into some great pantheon of artists because it's being brought on by your writing. You can think about it the same way that you might anxiety that makes it difficult for you to go to school or go to your job, you know, and try to find ways to cope with that you would with any anxiety. I think that I can't magically solve your anxiety. I mean, if I could magically solve anxiety, my life would be very different. But what I can tell you is I think just don't think about it as something that it is tied into your writing. It's part of you, you know, and you have to, I think, separate it out from the writing and just be like, I have an anxiety I need to address. And when you address that, I think the writing part is part of the getting better.
So this is specifically for all of you really coming from thinking about your background with the Neo-Futurists and that very specific form and sort of mindset of writing. Is there anything about that translated particularly well, or translated particularly in an interesting way into your audio fiction writing? If either you have weird niche artistic ventures you've done before that have done similar things as well?
Well, yeah, I touched on this earlier, but I think the thing I gained most out of, because I was with the ensemble for 12 years, and I think the thing I gained most from writing in that form was that sense of specificity and detail. And I think that's a really useful thing for audio, especially because as audio as a medium removes certain sensory input. We would occasionally do plays that were in the dark. Like, you know, that was something that would happen, and sometimes you would use a flashlight, and you use the flashlight to pinpoint the thing you want the audience to see, and sometimes you just keep doing it in the dark, and the text would have to, so there are little things that would happen every now and again, but I think, like, when you're building, like, an audio script, like, I would, like, if I'm thinking of a sound effect, I might say, like, the sound effect should happen at this point of the line, it's going to do something different if it happens here than if it happens there. And so just having that cognizance of that is something I think I gained from my time with the Neos.
Yeah, I think for me, working with the New York Neo Futures Company too, which is just, I learned more than anything like the value of constantly writing, the idea that you can constantly make a thing, and then going from the Neo Futures into Night Vale, the beauty of that was going into a serial fiction format was very similar to doing, you know, Infinite Wrench slash
formerly Too Much Light, was just make a thing and just move on from it. And that also, for me personally, it even ties into the anxiety issue too, which is to say that, like, listen, it's really hard to put myself out there and to think this is any good. And in retrospect, I did write a lot of things that aren't very good that actually made it to the stage or maybe even made it into the podcast that I'm like, I would totally do that differently now. I would have cleaned that up or done something else. But if you kind of are keeping moving and always generating something, it helped calm my nerves as a writer so much. And that was what I learned from the Neo Futurists, is that if you're always moving, always making things, you're definitely going to make bad things or things that you don't love 10 minutes from now or 10 years from now. But you're just making things, and it's just that existence that's really fun and nice. And we carry that into making what might fail as well.
I learned a lot of what I know about writing by watching the Neo Futurists. I came to New York when I was 22, and I thought I knew how to write, but, you know, I was 22. And I watched the Neo Futurists perform over and over. And the main things I learned were the idea of writing constantly, of not worrying about one thing, just keep moving, keep writing, keep trying stuff. Another was to find new ways to interact with your audience. That really was a revelation to me, all the different ways that you could interact with the energy of the audience. And the final was accepting the possibility of failure, that if you try interesting things, some of them won't work. And that's not even a downside, that's a benefit, that the energy is in the attempt, not in the success. And that was a huge kind of leap of thought that led me, I think, to more interesting writing.
Yeah, I think one thing that they came out of that, about that performance environment, but I think translates to other performance environments, was understanding the audience on your side. Because I think certainly there's a moment, like if you're the only one out on stage and you're in front of an audience, it's easy to find yourself in a mindset where it's like, I'm required to deliver something, and if I do not deliver satisfactorily, they will descend upon me and kill me. And actually, the audience really wants you to succeed. They will, like, an audience, unless your audience is full of sociopaths, somebody out there is going to watch, and if you fail, they still have this empathy for you, and they're still happy that you tried. And it's important. It's important for yourself to know.
Let's get a couple more. Got one right there. Hi.
Yeah, you too. So my question is, even though you guys write fiction, it's also a form of truth. I mean, grief is a truth, love is a truth, etc. And a lot of times these truths come from trauma in our own lives. Right after something happens, there might be this temptation to just write about it and get it out, but it might take a while for you to be able to do so in a critical and, quite frankly, beautiful and coherent way. So how do you know when there's enough distance between you and the trauma to write about it in a meaningful way?
That is a super interesting question that, as you can see, there's not a clear answer to, and that none of us jumped in with the answer.
You should go on your thing, I'm sorry, I'm really excited about it.
I'm really excited about talking about my trauma.
Yeah. No, I was thinking about our baseball discussion earlier.
Here's my answer, I guess, is you're ready when you're ready, which is obviously not the most helpful thing, but it is a thing of I think you don't know until you try, and sometimes you try and it doesn't work. I think about, like, Kurt Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse-Five, that, you know, he talks about, he wrote a lot of books about living through the Dresden bombing, and many of them were these serious attempts at the great novel about World War II. And none of them worked, and he tried again and again, and it just was too close to it. And then he wrote a novel that was funny about the biggest trauma in his life, and it worked. And it worked because he just found the angle and the distance that worked for him, but he didn't know until he tried a few times. I think about also, like, people sort of romanticize heartbroken artists. People love breakup albums. They love the idea that an artist made something when they were sad. But I think any artist would tell you that their best work happened when they were happy. They were maybe writing about a time when they were sad, but when you're sad, it's a real shitty time to work.
It's really hard to get anything done, and the stuff you get done is often not good. So yeah, I think if you're feeling in a good place, you're feeling strong enough, that's a sign of like, well, maybe now's the time to poke back at that time. That was really hard for me to see if there's something there for me to construct out of it.
I find journaling to be very helpful for that, for dealing with my own anxiety or trauma or tragedy in my life. But that's diary writing, right? Like, that's a thing I'm not publishing. That's a thing I just need to put into words, because sometimes I just personally like things in words. That's how I feel most comfortable communicating. And so some of that is just me telling myself that story. Me feeling like I've cataloged this for my future history, that I will look back and know what my emotions were at the time. And that feels like an archival thing. But to your question about how you write that for others to consume, I find that if I'm too in my own head, if I'm too much wanting the audience to feel the way I feel, I am less effective as a writer. I have to think entirely, I need to be 100% in the mind of the audience. And as Joseph said, sometimes if I'm just too much in my own sadness, and I think the same can go the other way. If I'm too amused by myself, I think that type of joke writing can be really bad too, because you are too taken with your own dad joke or whatever you've written down. But writing is a job, and it is a thing that you get better at because you've done it a whole lot. And so once you're able to sort of get into the mode of like, my job is to tell a story, and it's to tell a story to other people, whether that's through a podcast or on a stage or on a page, I need to be thinking about what's my customer service to the receiver of this story. And if I'm too much in what am I getting out of this, then that's not really helping the story.
I'll say one last thing. Which is sometimes you might write about it without knowing. Welcome to Night Vale is about my dad dying. I didn't know that for a very long time. I wrote it I started writing it about 6 months after he died. It was a really brutal time in my life. He died and I got fired from the job I had. And I started writing Night Vale. And it wasn't until years later that I realized it was me dealing with grief. I didn't know it, and it wouldn't have worked if I had. But sometimes you'll just, your brain will kind of do that for you.
That was a great question, thank you. Let's do one more.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I have a question. It's not so much about process of making the thing, or rather like creator self-care, if that's okay. So I work in comics, and comics is a very workhorse industry. We're given a lot of really short deadlines, and expected to kill ourselves for work. I recently published my own book, and I accidentally put myself in the hospital doing it. I worked myself to exhaustion, and I had to go to the ER. That wasn't great. And I learned the hard way that you really got to focus on taking care of yourself while taking care of your work at the same time. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts about that. How do you guys take care of yourself while still maintaining a healthy workflow?
For me, it's prioritization of just written, and I have to remind myself all the time of like what's the most important thing to me. And for me, it's being at home. You know, my wife Jillian is my closest dearest family member, my closest dearest friend, and I have a great time. We like playing games. We like our cats. We like watching TV. And these are things that I realize as I've gotten into my 40s that I'm like, I really value this. And the more I can have that, the better. And so it's the reminder of not beating myself up too much to get to where I'm going. That being said, that is one of the few privileges of getting older, which is the idea that you have a couple of decades of being able to put money aside, or having, I was a very fortunate person to get a full-time job out of college, and I maintain full-time jobs throughout, and that is a benefit that I had, that it was a steady flow of putting away that money. When I was in my 20s, though, that was so much harder, not being able to pay tolls.
roles or do things, and so you have to take on so many jobs, so many extra things, so many freelance gigs outside of your full-time job to pay rent, to have the time to spend at home with Jillian, to be able to have cats, to be able to watch TV, to do those things. And I think it's the prioritization of sometimes I have to say, I can't do any of that, I'm going to work my ass off for a couple of weeks, and then I have to stop. And then I feel the exhaustion kicking in. I worked 7 days a week for like a 2 months straight, and six of those days were in Western Mass, and one of those days was in New York City when I was doing that. And I hit the exhaustion thing as well, and got an ulcer, and everything was nearing that level of impossibility. And I think, to me, it's just knowing the waves to be able to like drive yourself hard, because you know you have to pay for things, to like rent. And then to be able to pull yourself back from time to time, just to remember to do that, to save just as little bit of money when you can, if you can, because that does pay off later down the road. But yeah, it's the full throttle and then remembering to pull back, because the priority is what I really want to be doing is spending time. This is for me, but what I really want to be doing is relaxing.
This is interesting for me to answer, because I'm not necessarily sure I'm actually good at this yet. I think a lot of like the past 2 decades, I've like full throttle in this sort of thing, and there are times that I'm not sure why I haven't broken down. One thing that's become very clear to me more recently than it probably should have, is to not suffer through that in silence, because I think I spent a lot of time not telling people close to me, like, how much crisis I was in, and not telling them, no, I'm actually, like, I'm feeling overwhelmed, I'm feeling avalanched by this, because I think, especially when it's something that you have so much investment in, so much emotional investment in something that you love doing, you can get to a place in your head where it's like, no, I alone am going to make this happen. And I'm not going to be weak about it. I'm not going to, like, all of those things can spiral through your head, and you keep it in there. And if you keep it in there, it does nothing but damage you. So yeah, I think I've slowly gotten used to like talking to other people and saying, like, yeah, I'm overwhelmed by this.
Similar to the answer about anxiety with writing, I think art is work, and so I don't believe there is any sort of separate category for art. I think a lot of the questions about dealing with the work of art is the same questions about dealing with any kind of work. And I think we all confront this idea of how we balance our health and the need to work. I mean, one answer is end capitalism.
That is my answer, too. That's collectively.
I mean, seriously, like, recognizing that some of it is systemic. That especially if you make art, it's undervalued work, and so it's work you're probably going to have to do on top of the work you make your money with, that you need with. And so it's work that you're having to do in a time that you shouldn't be resting. So just recognizing that some of this it's not you, there's a systemic problem here that is outside of yourself, that's outside of your personal control. It's not your fault. But also, yeah, I think, because it's work, thinking about it as how you would balance any kind of work. I used to, when Night Vale first became my full-time job, I would work 7 days a week, because I just, it was writing, so I'd just go down and I'd write every day, because every day was, I would kind of forget which days were weekends, because it just felt like, I'm here, this is my home, this is my office, so I'll go do it, and I really, it was very bad for me, and I at this point, I start taking weekends. I really try not to work on the weekends. I'm working today, so I might take tomorrow as a weekend. Because if you don't, it starts to get very difficult. You have to allow yourself those times. But yeah, the larger question of how we balance our health and our work, I don't know. I just know that it's the same struggle for art as it is for any work.
Y'all, thank you so much for coming out. I would want to...
Yay!
That is all for this episode, but your assignment is just beginning. Head on over to startwiththispodcast.com to join our membership community. Becoming a member allows you to share your assignments with other listeners, talk about what's sparking your creativity, and hopefully find future collaborators. Plus, you'll be able to ask follow-up questions about this and future episodes, and gain exclusive access to episodes where we answer those questions. Membership is just $5. That's like a bottle of subpar shampoo. We cannot wait to see what you're working on. Start With This is a production of Night Vale Presents. It is produced by me, Jeffrey Craner, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione, and theme song by Joseph Fink. If you'd like your own cover of the theme song featured on this show, email us at startwiththis@nightvalepresents.com or post it on our members' message board. All other music is by Caged Animals. Find more at cagedanimals.net. Very special thanks to Adam Cecil and Christy Gressman. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows. Thank you for listening.
Hello, iPod broadcast listeners. My name is Meg, and I am one of the esteemed tri-hosts of the beloved iBroad Good Morning Night Vale. I, along with my hilarious friends, fellow Night Vale actors, passionate eaters, and soft-hitting journalists, Symphony Sanders and Hal Lublin, are now over 100 episodes into our deep dive recap show of Welcome to Night Vale. We've tackled topics like soft meat crown headcanons, Cecil's fashion, and whether Steve Scones were really all that terrible, plus behind-the-scenes stories from the Night Vale creative family. And we've heard from listeners like you about queer representation, Night Vale named pets, major theories, minor questions, and of course, best and worst practices for alternative spa therapy services. If you know, you know. Check out Good Morning Night Vale every other Thursday, wherever you get your iBroads, iCasts, PodBroads, and podcasts. I think I like PodBroads the best. I'm a real PodBroad myself.